This is The Takeaway. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host and producer of NPR and WNYC's Consider This in for Tanzina Vega this week. It's great to be with you this Monday. Over the weekend, Charlotte Bennett, a former aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo, came forward with allegations of sexual harassment against the governor. Speaking to the New York Times, Bennett said that last spring, the governor repeatedly asked her invasive questions about her personal life. In reference to one conversation she had with Cuomo in June, Bennett told the Times, quote, "I understood that the governor wanted to sleep with me and felt horribly uncomfortable and scared." In response to the allegations, Governor Cuomo has released a statement that said that, quote, "To be clear, I never inappropriately touched anybody and I never propositioned anybody and I never intended to make anyone feel uncomfortable. But these are allegations that New Yorkers deserve answers to. And we will have that full statement on the web." Now, this came days after another former aide to Cuomo, Lindsay Boylan, published her own allegations of sexual harassment against the governor. The governor's press secretary called Boylan's claims false. Now, a number of New York politicians on both the right and the left are calling for Cuomo to resign. Meanwhile, Cuomo has come out in support of an investigation into the allegations, but the governor was further criticized for initially appointing a judge with ties to one of his advisors to oversee the probe. These allegations come as Governor Cuomo also faces a backlash over his alleged role in the cover-up surrounding the number of deaths in New York's nursing homes at the beginning of the pandemic. On the other side of the country, another governor who was initially praised for his handling of COVID-19 has also come under fire recently. California Governor Gavin Newsom is facing the possibility of a potential recall election later this year, which would give voters the chance to replace him. Newsom's critics are using the anger caused by his stay-at-home orders and the confusion with California's vaccine rollout to fuel momentum for the recall. Breaking down the backlash governors are facing is where we start today on The Takeaway. We're joined by my colleague, Gwen Hogan, a reporter for WNYC and Gothamist. Gwen, great to have you here.
Hi.
We're also joined by Phil Willon, staff writer for the LA Times, covering Gavin Newsom and California politics. Phil, thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Gwen, let's start with you. We mentioned that two former aides to Governor Cuomo have now accused him of sexual harassment. Can you tell us what we know about these allegations so far?
Sure. So in the last week, two women have come forward to describe sexual harassment while working in Governor Cuomo's office. Last week, Lindsay Boylan came forward with a post that she wrote on Medium. Now, she had alluded to the sexual harassment in a tweet last December, but she declined further interviews at the time. So now, last week, she wrote a lengthy account where she described in the years that she worked in the governor's office a series of uncomfortable incidents that culminated with a forcible kiss when she was trying to leave his office one day. She said that the governor would try or went out of his way to touch her lower back and legs, and one time suggested that they play strip poker as a joke when they were sitting very close to one another on a jet during a state trip. So after she released her account on Medium, 3 days later, the second woman came forward. She's a 25-year-old staffer named Charlotte Bennett. She doesn't allege that the governor forcibly touched her, but she says that he made a series of comments that made her feel deeply uncomfortable in the work setting. She says that he said he liked to date women in their 20s, that he suggested one time that she get a tattoo on her buttocks, and asked her at the height of the pandemic, when was the last time that she really had a hug? Now, like you said, he denied the first allegations that Lindsay Boylan described and says that he never touched anyone in any inappropriate way. But with the second allegation, he says, you know, he admits that some of his comments may have been interpreted as flirtation and he never meant to intimidate anyone.
And do we know what drove these women to speak up?
It seems that, you know, all of this has snowballed following her in, you know, since late January after a damning report that came out from the state attorney general on how the governor had handled the nursing home crisis last year during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic. And in the wake of that, he lashed out at somebody who was criticizing him, an Assemblyman Ron Kim. And when Ron Kim came forward and told New Yorkers that he received a threatening phone call from the governor, all these sort of stories have bubbled up in the weeks since.
There was also some controversy over the weekend because of how Cuomo handled the potential investigation into these allegations. So where do things stand there?
Right. First, the governor said, "I support an investigation," and named a political ally to do it. You know, there was immediate backlash, including from the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James. Then he said, okay, New York State Attorney General Letitia James and one of the state's top judges will conduct the investigation together. And the attorney general pushed back on that as well, demanding that he allow her to do a thorough and independent investigation. And because of state law, he has to authorize it in order for her to have subpoena power. So they went back and forth in kind of dueling press statements over the course of Sunday. And finally, he relented and he said that he would grant this referral. And she says she expects to receive subpoena power and the power to conduct this investigation solely.
Let's step back in time to last spring. Can you tell us how Governor Cuomo handled the beginning stages of the pandemic?
Right. I mean, you may remember Governor Cuomo stepped into what was at the time a dearth in national leadership. He, you know, at a time when President Trump was, you know, actively downplaying the severity of COVID-19, Governor Andrew Cuomo was leveling with the nation in these daily public briefings with, you know, endearing PowerPoint presentations that made people giggle. He told people that the situation was serious in New York, but that if we band together, we would get through it together. And it was a message that really resonated with people. You know, it resonated people within New York and all across the country and frankly the world. You know, at the height of the pandemic, he was getting letters from all over the country, you know, thanking him for his leadership. And he even won an Emmy for his press briefings.
And Phil, what about Governor Newsom? How did he handle the beginning stages of the pandemic?
Yeah, just like Governor Cuomo, Gavin Newsom got a lot of praise for his initial actions. California was the first state in the nation to issue a statewide stay-at-home order. That was in mid-March. Even before that, I don't know if you remember, but we had that big cruise ship off the coast that came in, and we had some planes come in from Wuhan as well. So California was already kind of getting a taste of the initial stages of the pandemic before things started to kind of go crazy out here on the West Coast. It was nothing like what hit the Northeast, but Newsom, again, he had daily briefings just like Governor Cuomo. He got a lot of praise. His job approval rating went through the roof. And a lot of the initial actions actually did pretty well. California has a relatively low COVID death rate compared to other states in the nation still.
And what was the public's response to Governor Newsom and how he handled the pandemic?
Well, initially, it was really good. I mean, I think like people across the country, people didn't know what this virus was doing. There was a lot of fear about the potential. There were a lot of unknowns. He got a lot of support for what he was doing and a lot of praise. Over time, I think like in New York and across the country, people started to kind of chafe with all the restrictions. They got tired of having their kids having to do distance learning. They got tired of having to work from home. We had millions of people out of work. Businesses were closed. The economic devastation was real, just like it has been everywhere. And so after a couple months, after the initial shock of this deadly virus, people just started to get a lot more impatient on a lot of the policies. And so you saw his favorability rating kind of steadily decline.
Now, both politicians are facing political backlash. So, Gwen, can you tell us about Governor Cuomo's relationships with politicians in his state during the pandemic? How did he work with them?
Yeah, I mean, he initially received a lot of support from local politicians. You know, the state legislator granted him these additional emergency powers at the beginning of the pandemic because everybody realized that the situation was so dire and that he needed to take sweeping executive actions in order to handle it. Phil described, like, that patience has kind of wore as the pandemic has gone on. Legislators, you know, started asking in last summer for, like, basic data, like how many people had died in nursing homes, and basically were stonewalled. And that's created tension, and it's kind of, you know, really snowballed, like I said, in the last few weeks, where now we're seeing all different kinds of things in consideration, from removing those emergency powers to, you know, some really progressive politicians and people on the right actually are now calling for impeachment or his resignation. So we've seen that that relationship really has strained.
And Phil, what about Governor Newsom? How has his relationship with elected officials changed from beginning to now?
It was pretty rosy at the beginning, and especially with local health officials and local county officials. That began to deteriorate as time went on. The Newsom administration was accused of having kind of a muddied message about what they wanted, not consulting with local health officials or local politicians when they implemented new policies, such as kind of we have like a tiered system about when some restrictions can be lifted. There were plans about the vaccine rollout that some of the local officials said they weren't consulted with. On the legislative side, the biggest criticism has been some of the contracts that have gone out. Basically, we've been spending billions of dollars for PPE and other measures. And the criticism is that he's done no-bid contracts. There's been questions raised about if some of these companies have prior relationships with him or had supported him politically. But that has not been as serious as back in New York, I don't think. It's been kind of a little bubbling below the surface a little more from the legislative point of view. With local governments, it's been a big problem.
Can you tell us about the now infamous French Laundry restaurant incident and why people were so angry?
Yeah, this happened in November, and Newsom was caught basically by a patron there, snapped a picture of him dining with friends at the French Laundry, which is a very posh restaurant in the Napa Valley. And this was at the same time he was urging Californians not to gather in big groups, not to congregate with people outside their home. And so it was kind of like a tinderbox. People got really upset because we'd been in lockdown since March, and here was the governor not wearing a mask with his friends, hobnobbing in this swanky restaurant. And even though, I guess under the rules in Napa at the time, you could dine outside restaurants, but it was just seen as a total hypocritical move on his part. And he still really hasn't recovered from that. And that added fuel to this budding recall effort out here. Which looks like it's going to qualify for the ballot.
Yeah. Can you explain what this recall effort means?
Yeah. So this began last June. And to recall a statewide politician in California, you need to get just under 1.5 million signatures. And the proponents say they have over that already. We don't know if those are valid signatures. They have to be from California voters. So it has to go through a kind of a check process. But What looks like it's going to happen is this, it looks like it will qualify, and come October or November, there will be a recall election, a special election with two questions. One, should Gavin Newsom be recalled? And if he is recalled, who would you like to replace him? And there'd be a slate of candidates that people could choose from.
Now, Phil, pretty much every California governor in recent history has faced an attempted recall. So, I mean, is this just par for the course in California, or do you think, based on your reporting, that this will actually have teeth?
You're right. I mean, I think every governor for the past 50 years has faced recall. Gavin Newsom himself has faced six different, this is the sixth attempt to recall him. I mean, the people were trying to recall him like the minute he got into office. This is unique, though, because we've always been one California governor who's been recalled in the history of the state. That was Gray Davis back in 2003. And that's when we were having rolling blackouts. That's when, after the dot-com bust, we were slashing our state budget. He had raised the car tax. So kind of like a whole host of things led to his demise. And that's when, famously, Arnold Schwarzenegger jumped in and was elected and served two terms as California's governor.
Gwynne, Governor Cuomo is clearly facing political backlash, as we've been saying. But have these recent controversies changed how the public generally views him?
It still feels very early to kind of weigh in on that. You know, there was a polling that came out recently that showed a slight dip in popularity since controversy bubbled up about this nursing home situation. But still, that's way higher than his approval was pre-pandemic times. So it still feels very soon to try to see, you know, exactly how this is going to sway the larger public's opinion on somebody who's had, you know, who's been governor for so long and has, you know, a deep political history in New York State.
And going back to his relationship with elected officials, there have been some recent tiffs, as you've mentioned, with other politicians in the state. Can you tell us what has happened between governor and elected officials and what the response has been?
Sure. I mean, the height of this has sort of expanded out of a situation with one state assembly member named Ron Kim, who represents a district in Queens. Now, he has been critical of how the governor has handled the situation specifically in nursing homes for the entire pandemic, the entire course of the pandemic. He now chairs the aging committee, this assemblyman, but his own uncle died in Flushing, in a Flushing nursing home from COVID last spring. And, you know, Assembly Member Kim spoke to reporters, a New York Post reporter, about a private conversation that Cuomo's top aides had with Democratic lawmakers. And after that story ran that described this private conversation, Kim came publicly out and said that he had received a threatening phone call from Governor Cuomo where he felt physically, like he was physically in danger. His wife was scared, he said. And then the governor, during a public press conference, spent 21 minutes of it berating this assembly member. That, I think, kind of, you know, I think Cuomo's calculation was that people would side with him, but really it caused, you know, this bubbling up of all kinds of stories about times that reporters and, you know, political activists and many, many people receiving calls from either Cuomo directly or from his staff members, you know, that were bullying. And, you know, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio came out in favor of Ron Kim and said, you know, many people in New York have gotten these phone calls. And it was sort of this open secret that many people in politics were aware of, but hadn't really been reported on the record. There was some reporting around threatening phone calls during the last election cycle for political opponents. But it seems like sort of that fear that had existed of publicly speaking against the governor kind of dissipated with Ron Kim coming forward. And in the wake of that, we've then seen these two women step forward and describe sexual harassment in his office.
And Gwen, with Governor Newsom, we're seeing this push to recall him. Are we seeing any of that here in New York?
That also feels very early. There are members, I mean, the Republican Party, yes, is calling for his, you know, steps towards his impeachment or his resignation. And there is a faction of the left, more progressive, younger lawmakers who have been more willing to criticize the governor, also calling for that. Whether or not it sort of passes into the more moderate centrist Democrats that are the majority control of both houses in the New York legislature, that is still, you know, still remains to be seen.
We've been talking to Phil Willon. He's a staff writer for the LA Times covering Gavin Newsom and California politics, and Gwen Hogan, a reporter for WNYC and Gothamist. Gwen, Phil, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Hey, we asked you out there what you thought about your governor and how they're doing, and you told us.
My name's Crash, and I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I think the governor has done the best he can, all things considered. Our state assembly, like most Midwest states, has an urban-rural divide that has a lot to do with race. And we're overrun with Trumpian Republicans that have convinced the rural areas to vote against their best interests. They cut off our governor's every effort at the knees, with packed courts, 11th-hour rule changes, endless lawsuits. He can't get anything done, and they're just shameless in their obstructionism.
This is Greg in Tigard, Oregon. I am pleased with our governor's response to the pandemic. She has been at the forefront of an active response that has prevented the spread of the coronavirus and saved lives.
I'm really disappointed that Governor Brown prioritized a lower-risk group of people, specifically educators, to be vaccinated before seniors and high-risk individuals in the state. She turned a public health issue into a political opportunity by making that choice.
My name is Denise McQuinn. I'm Dallas, Texas. Abbott responded abysmally to the crisis in Texas, but Abbott has always failed to help the people of Texas. He is not a public servant. He is a self-serving politician, and I might add, of the worst kind.
You can always hit us up, record a voice memo on your phone, and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
This is Jennifer from South Orange, New Jersey. As a fat woman, I have been nothing but weight shamed by the medical community for my entire life. It began at adolescence and it never stopped. It interferes with everything. People don't believe you when you complain about things or you're told that all of your troubles will be solved with weight loss.
Hello, I'm Anthony. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And I feel that the medical establishment at large shames many people from the African-American community in particular by continually using an example of institutional racism, a marker of health known as the BMI.
The BMI is an artificial and outmoded way of assessing health.
And once you trace the origins of its use, you will see what I am talking about.
Since the start of the pandemic, jokes and memes about gaining weight have been everywhere on social media. Everything from, quote, the quarantine 15 is the new freshman 15, to insensitive before and after caricatures. And now, fat phobia is making its way into the vaccination debate as people who qualify for the COVID-19 vaccine because of their body mass index, or BMI, are being shamed or scrutinized for getting priority. But fat phobia and fat stigma are far from new. They've long been widely acceptable within the medical establishment and in society at large. For more on this, we're joined by Virginia Soul Smith, journalist and author of The Eating Instinct. She's been covering COVID and weight stigma for the Medium publication Elemental. Virginia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
To start, can you tell us what the difference is between fat phobia, fat shaming, and weight stigma? Are these largely interchangeable terms, or are there important differences?
They are somewhat interchangeable. Weight stigma is the term that we see in research, and it refers to the set of negative beliefs and stereotypes and bias that crop up when a doctor sees a person in a higher body size, for example, and immediately assumes that this is someone who doesn't exercise, who needs a weight loss intervention. The terms fat shaming tends to be more of a personal thing, like maybe that's how your friends talk when they're eating, or the jokes, the memes that you just referenced. Fat phobia is a term used by activists who are really trying to reclaim the concept of fat for important reasons. And what they're saying there is all of this sort of bias and negativity that we're encountering, it's not based on science. It's not based on facts about larger bodies. It's based on a phobia, on a, you know, a form of stigma. And so this is similar to homophobia or racism. This is a form of oppression.
Can you remind us about the public health messaging around COVID and weight early on in the pandemic? What were we hearing?
So pretty early on, I think April was when the first study came out, we started to see research where they were looking often at sort of, you know, one hospital or one country's data set and trying to figure out who were the people most impacted by severe courses of COVID, who were most likely to end up on ventilators, you know, higher mortality rates. And they noticed a correlation between higher body size and more severe cases of COVID. But it's really important to understand that this was just a correlation. They were not saying that high body weights caused the severe COVID. They didn't really know what the relationship was. They were just noticing this trend. But that's not how it got reported in the media. Pretty much immediately, even within the research community, within the larger medical community, and certainly within the media, we started seeing headlines that high body weight equals bad COVID, you know, higher risk of COVID and worse cases of COVID. And it was presented as a causal relationship, which is not scientifically true. So that's when we started to see this sort of, you know, negative bias against high body weights really spike, because with any of the other risk factors about severe COVID, you know, when we talk about how the elderly are more vulnerable or medically fragile children are more vulnerable, you know, we frame that as this is a population to protect. When it comes to the weight, though, because we wrongly assume that weight is a matter of personal responsibility, we blame people for having this higher risk rather than saying, what is actually going on with this data? What is this relationship we're seeing and what does it mean? How do we protect if this is a more vulnerable population?
So what concrete research or data do we actually have on the relationship between COVID and weight? Is there any out there?
So there are a handful of studies that have found this relationship, but one of the best studies was done on California data. They found a relationship between more severe COVID cases and men with a BMI over 40. They did not find the relationship for women, and they did not find the relationship for lower BMIs. The BMI scale counts obesity at starting at 30, and so the lower range of the obesity scale was not impacted. But they did see this relationship between very high weight bodies and more severe COVID. But again, this wasn't a causal relationship, this was correlation. And what the research has not looked at and what we really need good data on is, what is it about being in a larger body that makes you more vulnerable to COVID? Is it something physical about the way your body is functioning, or is it the way your body is perceived by the medical system? Is it in fact weight stigma causing this heightened risk?
Why does fat shaming still happen? Why does it still seem to be this socially acceptable form of discrimination in a way?
Again, I think it comes back to this myth of personal responsibility. People who live in thin bodies and maybe have never struggled with their weight, or maybe they have and they've achieved some degree of weight loss, you know, temporarily, they tend to equate their body size with, I did all these things right. I have achieved this through my eating habits and my exercise and my willpower. We have a solid 50 years of research showing that that is not the case, that weight is actually determined by many, many factors in addition to lifestyle. Lifestyle does play a small role, but your genetics, your biological processes, the level of restriction you've lived with in the past in terms of dietary intake, even factors social determinants of health are a huge piece of this. So your income level, your, you know, other forms of lived depression. So to keep framing weight as a matter of personal responsibility is wildly incorrect, but it's just baked into the American psyche at this point. And it's taking a lot of work to undo it. And unfortunately, even in the medical realm, where we would hope that doctors would be more informed on the science of this, that bias shows up over and over when we study weight bias in medical professionals.
And I want to get to that in a second, but do we know how this form of discrimination intersects with other forms of discrimination, whether based on race, gender, class?
Oh, it absolutely intersects. You know, I mean, I am a small fat woman, but I'm also white. I'm financially stable. I have education. I'm a native English speaker. When I go into a medical setting, my weight may be part of the conversation. It certainly has come up from time to time, but I don't worry that it's going to become the only conversation because I have these other privileges that enable me to advocate for myself. For folks who are living in marginalized bodies that are also marginalized for race, for gender identity, sexual orientation, you know, English speaking abilities, the other physical abilities and disabilities, you know, the picture becomes much more complicated. And that's why, again, when we're looking at COVID, we're seeing the communities that are most impacted are the Black and brown communities, lower income communities, and weight is probably just an intersecting factor there. And again, none of these people are getting the worst cases of COVID because their bodies are in some way flawed. They're getting the worst cases of COVID because they're getting the worst medical care. They're living with this discrimination.
Virginia, what's been the role of the media in perpetuating fat stigma, both during and before the pandemic?
Unfortunately, the media has done a lot of damage. You know, weight loss is a really popular topic. It gets a lot of clicks on the internet. It sells a lot of magazines. You know, as someone who worked in women's magazines for a really long time, I can tell you weight loss is always on a cover for a reason. It sells. And so, of course, when the pandemic hit and, you know, we had two things that happened. We had this, you know, this sort of early blast of this research linking high weight bodies to worse cases of COVID. So we had this like larger fear at a time when we have so many fears that being in a higher body weight was going to make you more vulnerable to COVID in some way. And then we also had just the reality of pandemic life, which is that many folks, regardless of body size, have seen their lives change so dramatically. Eating habits may have shifted, exercise habits may have shifted. And bodies have changed because mm-hmm. that's what bodies do. Our bodies change in response to stress, and that's normal. But in our culture, we demonize that and we immediately want to fight it. And I think, you know, it's a natural thing that when we're feeling out of control in so many ways in our life right now, that we look at our body size and our food and our exercise as this thing we should try to control. It's because we're told over and over again it should be within our control, despite all the research showing that it's not. So the media has definitely played into this. You know, I'm seeing so many more weight loss stories focused on, you know, get back to your pre-pandemic body, the same way we talked about women getting back to pre-baby bodies, which is just a really negative concept. And on social media too, you know, influencers are talking about this a lot. There's a lot of jokey memes, you know, featuring people in bigger bodies and presented in really undignified and insulting ways. So it's really understandable that this is on everybody's minds. But again, we have to step back and say, like, this, first of all, even if it turned out that there was a causal relationship between a higher body weight and COVID, there's no way for you to lose enough weight before you go to the grocery store today to protect you from picking up COVID. I mean, it's just not something that makes sense to try to do. We know what works to prevent COVID. Wash your hands, wear your mask, socially distance. But in this time of great stress, of course, we're turning to this other thing.
Virginia, several states, including New York, where we're both based, have now opened up vaccine eligibility to people with BMIs or body mass index of more than 30. What are your thoughts on that? And what do you make of the backlash to it in some cases?
Well, again, it's this whole personal responsibility myth that's fueling the backlash, right? People are saying they shouldn't get vaccine priority because it's their fault they're in this body, which is false. It's just not how body size works. You know, it's a myth. We really need to dispel at every opportunity. I am absolutely pro people in larger bodies getting vaccine prioritization because we are at higher risk for worse COVID because of fat phobia, because mm-hmm. of medical weight stigma we're likely to encounter. And we deserve to be able to vaccinate ourselves against that to protect that. That said, this vaccine and linking those two things is continuing to perpetuate that stigma because all the lists you see of the comorbidities, it doesn't say high body weight because of weight stigma, you know, increases mm-hmm. your risk because of weight stigma. It just says obesity. So those sorts of decisions, I think, are definitely driven by stigma and paranoia about weight much more than they are driven by science. At the same time, though, yeah, if you qualify for the vaccine, get the vaccine. I mean, the more of us that get vaccinated, the better it is for fighting COVID in general. And that's what we need to do in part so we can free up some energy to work on this other issue.
And we keep saying BMI, BMI. Can you tell us how accurate it is actually to measure health in this country based on BMI?
BMI is a hugely flawed system. You know, the original data for BMI, the original formula, was invented by a Flemish astronomer and statistician in the 1830s. He was not a doctor, he was not a health professional, and he was not attempting to study health. He was attempting to track what he called the, quote, average size of man. So he developed this formula for tracking height and weight in Belgian men, so white European men, that we have then extrapolated to be this system we're using to measure everybody and to equate with health. But the bottom line is every medical professional would agree it is not a useful barometer of individual health. It can be useful for tracking population size and then tracking larger population trends. It is not a useful reflection of an individual's health, but we're still using it that way. So it's really problematic. I mean, it doesn't take into account muscle mass. You know, you have many professional athletes with, quote, obese BMIs, basketball players, football players, that kind of thing. But the real problem to me, often you'll hear people say, like, I can't believe I have this BMI when, look, I exercise so much, or look, I you wouldn't look at me and think I'm fat. The real problem is that it continues to equate health and weight. So it causes this perpetuating the stigma against folks in bigger bodies. That's the real danger of BMI, is how much we keep holding on to it. It's used to determine whether insurance pays for certain medical procedures. It's, you know, kids have their BMIs calculated in school, which can be a horribly stigmatizing experience for children. And, you know, I've seen myself, it can really shift the tone of a conversation with a doctor. Once they have that BMI in their sights, they kind of start only seeing the patient in the context of where they are on the BMI scale.
And the key words in that BMI study, right, are white men. They used white men as a reference for everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, this was the 1830s in Belgium, like this is what they were doing, but it certainly has not been, you know, properly expanded upon since then. It's, you know, we're still sort of tied to this very archaic formula and using that. And, you know, same with pediatric growth charts that use the body mass index. They are mostly calculated based on data collected between 1963 and 1988 on white children. And this is the growth chart that pediatricians are telling parents to measure their kids' health by. So yeah, it's a deeply flawed system.
Virginia, lastly, how can we be better as individuals and as a society at pushing back against fat phobia and shaming in our own lives as the pandemic continues and beyond?
So one of the best things to do for anyone who feels that this is safe and available to them, because it won't feel safe for everybody, but one of the best things to do is with your own healthcare providers, say, I don't want to be weighed unless you're calculating a medication that is, anesthesia, they need to know your weight to calculate the dose. Mm. The vast majority of times when we go to the doctor's office, we don't need to get on a scale. And if we start pushing back on that, which you absolutely have the legal right to do, and say, I'm declining the weight today, that's going to motivate your doctor to say, okay, well, now I have to ask you more questions about your diet and your lifestyle and your stress level and your sleep. And so that's going to, A, give you a more enriching medical experience because your doctor is not going to be so focused on your weight, whether you're in the normal range or the higher ranges. And it's also going to help shift this conversation away, you know, entirely from this weight-centric ideal. What we really need is a weight-neutral approach to healthcare, where patients are evaluated on their health on their biomarkers, things like blood pressure, cholesterol levels, blood sugar, and, you know, also the things that really determine our health in day-to-day life, our activity levels, our stress levels, our sleep. And, you know, you can work on all of those issues. You can work on all of those health problems without ever prescribing weight loss.
Virginia Soul Smith is a journalist and author of The Eating Instinct. Virginia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Having me.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina this week, and this is The Takeaway. Last week, the Cherokee Nation Supreme Court ruled unanimously to remove the phrase by blood from the tribe's constitution and laws. The decision is particularly meaningful to descendants of Black people who were once enslaved by the tribe, known as Cherokee freedmen. According to the court, an 1866 treaty signed by the Cherokee Nation affirmed the tribal citizenship rights of freedmen, but their place within the tribe, including their ability to run for tribal government positions, has been questioned and challenged by other Cherokee Nation members over time. Joining us now is Allison Herrera, Indigenous Affairs reporter for KOSU. Allison, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me back.
This recent ruling is connected to a federal court decision from 2017. Can you tell us what was at issue in that case and how did the court rule?
Well, the 2017 ruling stemmed from in 2007, Cherokee Nation voters approved an amendment to the Constitution to limit citizenship to Cherokees who could prove they were, quote, by blood. And so a lawsuit was filed. And in 2017, a federal district court judge in D.C. ruled in favor of the freedmen. The case was known as Cherokee Nation versus Nash. And they said that freedmen should enjoy full citizenship of the tribal nation according to an 1866 treaty that they signed. So, you know, in 1866, the Cherokee Nation signed a treaty to establish a relationship again with the federal government after the Civil War. A lot of people don't know that the Cherokee Nation fought on the side of the Confederacy during the Civil War. And so this treaty was to establish a relationship with them. And so part of the negotiation said that the tribal nation needed to give freedmen citizenship. And so over time, that has been challenged. And in the Cherokee Nation versus Nash case, Marilyn Van, who was a plaintiff in that case, she had filed for citizenship and, you know, wanted to get her citizenship in 2001 and was told, no, you don't qualify. And so she filed a suit against the Cherokee Nation and won her and got her citizenship in 2006. And then that brings us to 2007 when that amendment was made to the Constitution. So I think it's really important to note that citizenship laws in the Cherokee Nation are not based on race or blood quantum. Some tribes have that, but not the Cherokee Nation. Many feel like that requiring blood quantum is a colonialist, antiquated way of saying who is and who isn't. You know, citizenship is based on community. Who can claim you? What community are you part of? And I tell people to think of it like if you were a citizen of France, you know, it's like that. You know, your culture, your community, the people that you know, people that can claim you. And so that's a big difference. And I think that's when the Supreme Court of Cherokee Nation struck that by blood language from the Constitution. I think they were affirming that. Mm-hmm.
And you've spoken to some descendants of Cherokee freedmen since the court ruling was announced. How are they reacting to the news?
I spoke with Marilyn Van. You know, the striking of this language was in, like you mentioned in your intro, she is running for a seat on the tribal council and somebody had challenged her candidacy. And so I spoke with her after this ruling and she was really surprised. She was really happy. And she feels, first and foremost, she is Cherokee. That's her heritage. You know, I remember when I first interviewed her 5 years ago, she said, you know, I knew who my family was, you know, I knew who we were and I felt like I'm a Cherokee just like anybody else. And so she's looking forward to, you know, running for her seat in the tribal council and the election is June 6th. And she said, you know, I'm looking forward to earning the trust of Cherokees and representing them.
So other than being able to say run for a seat, what will some of the most immediate impacts on the Cherokee Nation Supreme Court ruling be within the tribe?
I'm not sure if there are any other immediate impacts. I think this was the one that was really going to be most impacted. I mean, there are freedmen citizens enrolled in the tribe right now, and they enjoy the same benefits that other Cherokee Nation citizens have. You know, they're able to vote, they're able to receive health care, they're able to receive their vaccine, they're able to enjoy those benefits. And I think this striking the by blood language was really, some feel that this was just the last way to, you know, to really affirm that there's one type of Cherokee citizen, full stop. There is no, you know, you're Cherokee by blood, you're Cherokee, you know, you're a descendant. There's one type of Cherokee citizen, full stop. And that's what this decision affirms.
And what have the leaders of the Cherokee Nation said about the court's ruling?
They're really happy. I mean, Attorney General Sarah Hill really welcomed Monday's opinion. And she remarked on the language that Justice Shauna Baker wrote. You know, she said, when we signed this treaty, the federal government said that they were going to uphold their end of the trust responsibility. And so by us taking out this language, that means that we are upholding our end of the trust responsibility by allowing freedmen to become citizens. And, you know, it, particularly in that ruling, there was this language that referenced the McGirt decision from last summer. If you'll recall, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that the Muscogee Creek Nation was never disestablished. And that also, you know, had applied to other tribes. And so, you know, in the ruling that Justice Shauna Baker wrote, she said, 155 years after the 1866 treaty, Native Cherokees must fully step into the promise they made on the far end of Trail of Tears. And that's a direct quote from Justice Gorsuch's writing from last summer in the Supreme Court decision. And she also said, by doing so, the Cherokee Nation as a whole lifts itself into the 21st century and sheds the heavy weight of antebellum and pervasiveness of racism and racial injustice for all. So those were words that were written in the decision on Monday. And you know, a lot of people commented on how thoughtful that was.
So in 2007, around 75% of Cherokee Nation members approved an amendment that added the by blood language to their constitution. Why was there so much support for that language at the time then?
You know, I can't really speak to that. What I will say is, since this decision has come down, there are people who feel that the Supreme Court and the Attorney General had no right to take that language out of the Constitution. And they're really upset about it. They feel like this was something that should have been put to the people. This was something that should have been done by a vote. And people that are upset about it say that would be like, you know, a justice striking words from the United States Constitution. How is that legal? That's not legal. And they say that this move is an illegal move on the part of the Cherokee Nation leadership. And so they're quite upset about it. And I think, you know, the other four tribes in Oklahoma, the other four larger tribes, the Seminole, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, and the Muscogee Creek, they all have freedmen as well. And I spoke with an official from Muscogee Creek Nation yesterday about this decision and what implications that has for their tribal nation. And he said, you know, we don't want to just take something out of our constitution. We're not going to go the way of Cherokee Nation. We want to have a discussion about this issue. It's a really important discussion, and And we really want to talk about it, and it's time we talk about it. And if we're going to make any decisions about citizenship, we're going to let the people decide.
Yeah. What is the relationship between freedmen, descendants, and other tribal nations in Oklahoma?
Well, I do know the Seminole Nation. I've spoken and interviewed a Seminole Nation freedman descendant, and she's on the tribal council. She can vote, but she claims that she cannot enjoy other citizenship privileges, such as health care or other things. And so other freedman descendants don't have citizenship in the tribe at the moment. And I think that this decision, freedmen descendants who I've spoken with say that this decision on Monday, they're, you know, willing to use this as a platform to put pressure on tribal leadership to do so. Whether or not that works, I don't know. But yeah.
And did last summer's racial justice uprising lead the Cherokee Nation to maybe reevaluate the legacy of slavery within the tribe?
I think that the discussions around racial justice and racial injustice have certainly given the freedmen a platform to discuss these issues. And also, this is the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. I think that that's also another platform where freedmen feel like they can discuss these issues more openly. Marilyn Vann is the president of this organization called the Descendants of Freedmen of the Five Tribes. And they meet every month, and they talk about citizenship issues. And certainly, you know, last summer, Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. did remove a Confederate monument from the lawn out in front of the Cherokee Nation Courthouse in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. So I think there are steps that the Cherokee Nation are taking to, you know, reckon with their history of, you know, being part of, you know, fighting on the part of the Confederacy. And as Justice Shauna Baker wrote, shed the heavy weight of antebellum, the antebellum. So yeah, I definitely think that the conversations in the wake of the killing of George Floyd last summer have given the freedmen a platform to talk about their own racial justice issues.
Allison Herrera is an Indigenous Affairs reporter for KOSU. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's the show, folks. It was so nice to be here with you, and I hope you really enjoyed the show. Of course, you can call us if you have any ideas or comments at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or you can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also send me a tweet. I am at Rebe Ibarra C. That's REBEIBARRAC. Thanks so much for listening. I am Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega this week, and this is The Takeaway.